It is Wednesday, August 29th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, millions of refugee children are missing school. A new report accuses the Saudi-led coalition in Yemen of human rights abuses. And a new book pays tribute to the pioneering American women pilots of the 1920s and 30s.
We have reduced this story to just one woman, to Amelia Earhart.
It's all ahead. The UN Refugee Agency reports 4 million refugee children are missing out on an education, a situation that bodes ill for their future and for the well-being of the communities in which they live. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva, where the UNHCR has launched a new report, Turn the Tide, Refugee Education in Crisis.
The UN Refugee Agency reports enrollment of refugee children in school is not keeping pace with the growing refugee population, which has reached unprecedented levels. Globally, the UNHCR cares for nearly 20 million refugees, and more than one half are children. This means the number of refugee children needing to go to school also has risen, but this is not happening. UNHCR Senior Education Advisor Ita Shee says 61% of refugee children are attending primary school, dropping dramatically to 23% for secondary school. This, she underscores, is compared with 84% of children globally.
So if we put those figures together, we know that a refugee child is five times more likely than any other child not to be in school. This gets much worse as we get up to higher education level, and we have again seen that the percentage of 1% of refugees going to university has not increased in the past year, despite all of the efforts.
The report notes 92% of all refugees are hosted in developing countries. It says this poses problems because these poor countries have little money to provide quality education for their own children, let alone for refugee children. The UNHCR is urging host countries to enroll refugee children in their national school systems. It says putting these two groups together will result in a better educational result rather than keeping them in separate parallel systems. The agency is calling on the international community to invest in refugee children's education. At the same time, it urges donors to provide sustained financial support to improve the school systems in the developing host countries. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. The White House counsel Don McGahn will depart. The U.S. economy grows a bit faster than first thought. The United Nations issues a report on human rights abuses in Nicaragua. And services for the late Senator John McCain are underway in Arizona. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
A new Canadian study suggests that including high-protein milk with breakfast may help those with type 2 diabetes better maintain their blood glucose levels throughout the day, and that it helps the eater feel full. The study, published in the Journal of Dairy Science, also shows that consuming the high-protein milk at lunch helps reduce the eater's appetite compared to those consuming a lower or no-protein product. H. Douglas Goff, who led the team of researchers from the University of Guelph and the University of Toronto, both in Ontario, Canada, says that their study confirms just how important consuming milk at breakfast is in helping to slow the digestion of carbohydrates and maintain lower blood sugar levels. According to the World Health Organization, 425 million people between the ages of 20 and 79 are living with diabetes, with the number predicted to rise to 629 million by 2045. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, Iraqi health officials cite a spike in waterborne illnesses during the past 2 weeks. A Houthi rebel-controlled TV station Wednesday said the Shiite rebel group in Yemen fired a ballistic missile at a military camp inside Saudi Arabia. It appeared to confirm a Saudi military statement Tuesday that its anti-missile defenses intercepted a missile fired towards the city of Najran, causing no casualties. The Houthi report came a day after UN investigators accused the Saudi-led coalition and the Houthis of rights abuses that may amount to war crimes. They include airstrikes on civilian targets, arbitrary detentions, rape, torture, enforced disappearances, and child recruitment. Charles Garraway is a member of the Group of Eminent Experts on Yemen.
The Group of Eminent Experts has reasonable grounds to believe that the governments of Yemen, the United Arab Emirates, and Saudi Arabia are responsible for human rights violations. The Group of Eminent Experts has also reasonable grounds to believe that the de facto authorities are responsible in the areas over which they exercise effective control for human rights violations. Individuals in the government of Yemen and the coalition, including Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, may have conducted attacks in violation of the principles of distinction, proportionality, and/or precautions, which may amount to war crimes. We continue to witness a total disregard of the suffering of the people of Yemen. This crisis has reached its peak, with no apparent sight of light at the end of the tunnel.
They cited nearly 6,500 deaths in the past 3.5 years of conflict, although the real figure may be higher. The conflict has also created one of the world's worst humanitarian crises. Anthony Billingsley is a senior lecturer in Mideast politics and international law at the University of New South Wales. He spoke about the UN report with International Edition's Victor Beattie.
As far as the air campaign is concerned, we had a school bus attacked recently. We've had markets blown up. We've had weddings attacked. The problem in the report, or for the report, is that international law says that, yes, we accept that there will be civilian casualties in any conflict, but those casualties must be proportionate to the military objective. And it's impossible for the people preparing the report to definitively say the Saudis' intent was to kill the civilians.
Is this the UN's way of just getting this 3.5-year-old war to an end?
The UN has been trying for quite some time, and we had 2 years ago, I suppose, negotiations in Kuwait. We've had a special envoy of the Secretary General trying to bring the two sides together. It's really hard to know what is actually driving the Saudis now beyond Mohammed bin Salman's pride, I suppose, and his political position. The Saudis keep putting up impossible demands that the Houthi must lay down their arms and withdraw from all areas that they've occupied, demands that they know that the Houthi cannot accept. Now, this report could put more pressure on the Security Council, and that's, I think, where the real action has to take place. And up until now, the Security Council has been largely mute on this question.
Well, what will the Council do?
Well, this Council could call for the parties to cease and desist and to, under Chapter 6 or Chapter 7 of the Charter, some sort of peace monitoring, peacekeeping, some sort of operation that would keep the two sides apart and at least stop the fighting, and then move on to some sort of negotiation.
Aside from the siege of the rebel-controlled port on the Red Sea of Hodeidah, not much has, as you indicated earlier, not much really has changed on the battlefield over the past number of years.
And Hodeidah was going to be the big victory for the Saudis, and especially the Emiratis. But it's just become a bit of a stalemate. Same with Taif in the Highlands, and no political progress. And this is where something has to be done, and hopefully this report will start to force people to consider a political solution.
Anthony Billingsley, a senior lecturer at the University of New South Wales. Iraqi health officials say that a health crisis stemming from water pollution and a shortage of clean drinking water has worsened in recent days as hospitals in the southern port city of Basra treat more than 1,000 cases of intestinal infections on a daily basis. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo that the problem was exacerbated several months ago when Turkey cut back on water distributed to the Tigris and Euphrates rivers.
A crowd of young men chanted during a street protest Tuesday in the southern port city of Basra, demanding the central government and Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi increase the quantity of clean drinking water allotted to their province. Abadi vowed to increase spending on infrastructure for the province during a visit to Basra in July. A young man whose friend was killed during a protest several weeks ago broke down and sobbed over protesters' inability to force Iraqi leaders to improve the condition of public services in Basra, especially the region's worn-out water infrastructure and insufficient quantities of drinking water allotted by the central government. Some health officials in Basra warn that a cholera outbreak is possible due to water pollution and waterborne parasites that have made thousands of people sick in recent days. The Director General of the Basra Health Department, Dr. Riyad Abdul Amir, told Al Hora TV the situation continues to worsen. He says more than 17,500 cases of intestinal ailments resulting from contaminated drinking water have been treated by Basra hospitals during the past 2 weeks alone. Abdul Amir says the problem stems from insufficient fresh water supplies coming into the city via canals and water pipes from the north. Salty water, which has infiltrated the water network, he asserts, is known to reduce the efficacy of chlorine used to treat and kill bacteria in drinking water. Dr. Safa Kazim, who has been treating dozens of cases of intestinal problems and diarrhea in Basra's Sadr teaching hospital each day, says the city's water supply is not safe to drink. She says the degree of water sterilization is minimal and that Basra's water is very salty and has an extremely high level of microbes in it, along with a high degree of chemical pollution. Basra's governor, Asad al-Adani, told Al Hora TV that his province has been suffering from numerous infrastructure problems for a long time. He says the water network in Basra hasn't been updated in at least 30 years, and the old pipes often break, mixing drinking water with sewage water. Adani says not enough fresh water is arriving via the region's only canal from Zikar province to the north. He thinks a strong current of fresh water will flush out salty water seeping into the water network from the sea. Adani adds that the population of Basra has more than doubled since the water network was last updated in the early 1990s. Iraq's individual provinces have been fighting for water amid a generalized shortage since Turkey severely curtailed the number of cubic meters of water distributed to both the Tigris and Euphrates rivers in early June. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
This is International Edition. The world remembers aviation pioneer Amelia Earhart, who vanished on an around-the-world flight in 1937. But there were other prominent American female pilots in the 1920s and 1930s who were groundbreakers as well, including Arkansas-born Louise Thadden and New Yorker Ruth Nichols. Author Keith O'Brien brings fresh attention to these women pilots in his new book, Fly Girls. It's now a New York Times bestseller. I asked him why the lesser-known women pilots are often overlooked.
You know, I think in the decades that have passed since this time and since Amelia's disappearance, we have reduced this story to just one woman, to Amelia Earhart. You know, she was the most famous of them all, certainly by 1937 when she disappeared. And her disappearance added mystery and legend to her fame. You know, in the years after she disappeared, there was, of course, much interest about what happened to her. And her husband, it should be noted, George Putnam, formerly of Putnam Publishing, he also did what he could to keep her name in the news. And I think the combination of her fame, the mystery around her disappearance, and Putnam's interest in keeping her famous even after she had gone, sucked all the oxygen out of the room and ultimately reduced this story of women in aviation to just one, when really that wasn't the case at all.
I didn't realize until reading your book that part of Earhart's first solo flight, her first transatlantic solo flight to Europe, was done by a man named Bernt Balchen, who was from Norway. He was, I guess, a consultant for her. He actually flew the plane. Earhart was with him. He flew the plane from New Jersey to Canada, to New Brunswick and Newfoundland. And then from Newfoundland, Earhart took over. But I was never even aware of that.
Yeah, we have erased that bit of the story, haven't we? You know, and that is significant. You know, she does fly solo from Newfoundland to Ireland, and so that is a solo Atlantic crossing. But Bernt Balchen was not just a male aviator. He was one of the most experienced flyers and ocean aviators in the world at that time. And he does fly her plane all the way to Newfoundland. And it's significant because Ruth Nichols, just 1 year earlier, tried to beat Earhart across the ocean, tried to make this solo flight, and she was going by herself. And Ruth Nichols does suffer a mishap in Canada on one of her refueling stops, which was not that uncommon at the time. And it's because of that mishap, because of happenstance and poor luck and a bit of poor planning, that Ruth Nichols doesn't get across the ocean first. And when Earhart makes her attempt 1 year later in 1932, Putnam, who of course has his hands in everything that Earhart does, wants to take no chances here. And so it's Bernt Balchen who's going to fly that plane up the coast all the way to Newfoundland.
Also, your book describes in detail the danger in flying. It's tremendously dangerous for both for men and for women. And then there's, of course, the horrible case of Florence Klingensmith, who was piloting a GB plane and was killed in an air race near Chicago.
It was incredibly dangerous at this time, especially air racing. Inevitably, pilots flying oftentimes single-propeller, open-cockpit machines would crash. I mean, they're flying at a high rate of speed, low to the ground, in competitive races. This was extremely dangerous. It was dangerous for the men. It was dangerous for the women. But there was a double standard. When a man crashed or died, as often happened in these races, he was hailed as a hero and often given grand tributes and memorials right there on the field with flybys and 21-gun salutes and ashes scattered, you know, from the sky. And when a woman crashed or died in the races, as sadly would happen, she often didn't even get the most basic, decent human respect. Instead of being hailed as a hero, instead of being given grand tributes, the women who crashed and died were sometimes blamed for their own failures and blamed in the press. It was really infuriating to read how they were treated, during this time.
Well, as we mentioned earlier, of course, Amelia Earhart vanished. Louise Thaden eventually left flying. She was married and had young children. And later on, unfortunately, Ruth Nichols killed herself. But certainly, looking back on these women, in so many ways, they were ahead of their times. They also, though, when you think about it, they really lived on the edge.
They were living on the edge. This was to be a woman in the late 1920s, not just flying planes, but racing planes, put you in a very small group of people. It made you a true radical, a real renegade. They absolutely were living on the edge, and they would all go missing, really, in their own way. You know, Amelia, of course, disappears. Others disappear right before our eyes. And that's not just something that happened. After the air racing time is over, after this decade ends, these experienced female aviators, they can't get a job doing the thing they love. They can't get hired at the airlines. Some of them can't even get hired to be flight instructors. The sexism and discrimination remained, and it made it hard for a lot of these women. You know, Ruth Nichols wasn't the only early female aviator who struggled after the spotlight turned away. A lot of them did because they couldn't get hired to do the thing they loved.
Keith O'Brien, author of Fly Girls. That is our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is determined to take a comprehensive approach to the Iranian regime because of the wide-ranging nature of Iran's malign activities, including violent and destabilizing behavior toward the United States, its allies, and the Iranian people themselves. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo recently announced the creation of a special group of foreign affairs professionals at the State Department called the Iran Action Group to implement and coordinate a comprehensive approach. In announcing the IAG, as it is called, Secretary Pompeo noted that since the United States withdrew from the Iran nuclear deal, which failed to restrain Iran's nuclear progress or its campaigns of violence, President Donald Trump has instituted a campaign of pressure, deterrence, and solidarity with the long-suffering Iranian people.
Our hope is that one day soon we can reach a new agreement with Iran, but we must see major changes in the regime's behavior both inside and outside of its borders. The Iranian people and the world are demanding that Iran finally act like a normal nation.
Special Representative for Iran Brian Hook will lead the Iran Action Group. He told reporters that the team will continue to work with allies and other nations around the world to build the broadest level of international support for the approach the U.S. is taking, building on areas of agreement and working to find consensus on areas of disagreement.
When you look at the range of Iranian threats, especially around missiles and cyber, maritime aggression, terrorism, these are concerns of other nations. The United States is not alone in that regard.
Special Representative Hook noted that if the Iranian regime demonstrates changes in its behavior, then the president is prepared to engage in dialogue in order to find solutions. But, he said, the sanctions relief, the reestablishment of full diplomatic and commercial relations with the United States, and economic cooperation with the United States can only begin after we see that the Iranian regime is serious about changing its behavior.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.